The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wants to pump up enthusiasm for a climate treaty. It's supposed to be finished in December in Copenhagen, but it's in deep trouble.
Climate change is a hard problem. An effective treaty would eventually require the global economy to change directions entirely, with a shift away from fossil fuels and toward cleaner sources of energy. There's at least serious talk about starting that transition. The United States is a key player, and the House of Representatives passed a bill that is intended to move in that direction. But the issue is stalled in the Senate. Jason Grumet at the Bipartisan Policy Center says there are three main reasons for that.
The global recession, the extent to which the healthcare debate has now really crowded out all other political activity, and the deep mistrust that people in our Congress and across our country now have about market-based approaches to problem solving.
The idea of creating vast new markets to buy and sell carbon emissions suddenly sounds like not such a great idea, since exotic markets in bundled mortgages nearly led to economic collapse a year ago. Grumet says given time, there are ways to solve these problems.
The real challenge, though, is getting beyond the kind of vitriol that is now marking our larger political discussion, because if that remains, I think we're going to find ourselves not making progress on any of the important issues facing the country.
And time is running short. Congress needs to agree on a domestic climate policy before the Obama administration can negotiate a credible international deal. And it's looking like there simply won't be time to come up with a climate bill before December, when the next climate treaty is supposed to be negotiated in Copenhagen.
But U.S. isn't the only problem.
Kelly Sims Gallagher at Tufts University says China is also an impediment. The Chinese government is demanding that the industrialized world make drastic cuts in its emissions before China agrees to reduce its own. Gallagher says this is not helpful.
But we have to understand China's stance as a negotiating position right now.
Countries often talk tough as a deadline approaches. She says, time's up. The United States and China, which are by far the two biggest contributors to global warming, need to sit down together and start getting serious.
If they don't start doing that this week, it's hard to imagine being able to have enough time to get through all of the contentious issues and come out of Copenhagen with an agreement.
If you ask David Victor at the University of California, San Diego, about the prospects of a deal by December...
Well, they're looking pretty bad.
The lack of U.S. domestic legislation is a big blow. So's the global economy. Rich countries don't have much money to offer the developing world, and money is what developing countries expect from these talks to help them cope with the consequences of climate change. So Victor is among a rising chorus of voices saying it's time to start thinking seriously about Plan B.
I think what needs to happen between now and Copenhagen is the diplomats need to sift through this huge list of issues on which they can't agree and find the small list of items where they can agree and where, if they fail to agree, there's going to be a big harmful impact on climate diplomacy.
For example, put in writing promises countries have already made so they don't back away from them. And don't expect to negotiate global emissions reduction targets.
And then develop a very distinct game plan for the 2 or 3 years following the Copenhagen process.
He says the worst-case scenario would be if nations lower their expectations for Copenhagen so much that nothing happens, yet everyone declares victory and goes home. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Remember when the scariest environmental villains were chemicals destroying the ozone layer? Well, back in 1987, the most effective environmental treaty ever was passed, and it eliminated that problem. But as NPR's Richard Harris reports, it may have created a new problem.
In the basement of the Hart Senate office building on Capitol Hill, a thirsty staffer feeds a few coins into one of the many soda machines. As it happens, machines like this, along with refrigerators and air conditioners, use gases called HFCs as coolants. HFCs are non-flammable and they don't hurt the ozone. But Kurt Davies at Greenpeace says when it comes to global warming, they're not so good.
These gases are tremendously powerful greenhouse gases. We call them the super greenhouse gases. They're the global warming threat that no one's really heard about.
Molecule for molecule, they are hundreds of times better at trapping heat in the atmosphere than the most important greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide. HFCs were invented as a replacement for refrigerants like CFCs, which were destroying ozone. The good news is at the moment, HFCs are only responsible for a few percent of human-induced global warming. Samuel Labuddy from a small nonprofit called the Environmental Investigation Agency says the bad news is global production is poised to take off to satisfy the world's growing desire for fridges and air conditioners.
Right now, what's happening is that China and India are beginning to invest very, very heavily in HFC production.
Labuddy's group started out investigating the illegal trade of banned ozone-destroying chemicals, but they quickly realized that the perfectly legal trade in HFCs could do far more damage if the industry grows as fast as is now projected.
So much so that by 2050, the global warming effects of HFCs will be sufficient to cancel out all the reductions in CO2 that we're looking at getting under the United Nations Copenhagen Climate Talks Agreement and things of that nature.
Environmental groups have been trying to do something about HFCs for well over a decade. Finally, there's progress. Two small countries have proposed phasing out the chemicals by amending the treaty that protects our ozone layer, the 1987 Montreal Protocol. Last week, the United States, Canada, and Mexico agreed to support a treaty amendment that wouldn't ban HFCs entirely, but that would dramatically reduce their production. Of course, that means the air conditioning and refrigeration industries have to find something else to use. And that brings us back to the soda machines in the Senate office building. Kurt Davies from Greenpeace feeds a couple of dollar bills into a Pepsi machine.
Bit of a robot machine, isn't it? I've never seen that before. It kind of picks it up and gives it to you.
The robot is showy, but that's not the real point of this test machine.
What's novel about this machine is that it's not like the old-fashioned vending machines or your refrigerator at home. The cooling is done with carbon dioxide,
which is a greenhouse gas, but these machines use so little that that's not an issue. The machine is not only free of HFCs, it also uses less electricity. Carbon dioxide doesn't work in refrigerators, but hydrocarbons like propane and isobutane do. In fact, there are 100 million fridges worldwide. Problem solved?
Well, it's not as simple as it sounds.
Karim Onran is at the Air Conditioning, Heating and Refrigeration Institute, a trade group. He says carbon dioxide may work in vending machines, but it would never work to run the huge air chillers in the hotel where we meet, and neither would flammable chemicals like isobutane.
Imagine if you had 1,000 pounds or more of isobutane in your chiller in this building and something happened. I mean, the entire building probably will be wiped out.
Even so, his industry knows that HFCs will eventually have to go, so they are now scrambling to find substitutes that will solve the current problem without creating yet another. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Scientists have made a surprise discovery about our moon. It is generally thought to be bone dry, but now three new studies show that actually the lunar dirt holds stores of hidden water. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Nobody thought the surface of the moon was covered with water. Even the scientists who saw the first hints of water didn't believe it.
Like any normal person, you'd say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, it can't be there. It must be calibration problems.
Carly Peters says her team thought their instrument must be out of whack. They spent months looking at their data.
Arguing amongst ourselves what could be real, what could not be real, and it would not go away.
Peters works at Brown University. She heads up research with a NASA instrument called the Moon Mineralogy Mapper, which went up on a spacecraft built by India to orbit the moon. To make sure this mapper really had picked up water, the scientists got data from two other spacecraft that flew by the moon. It turns out those probes detected signs of water, too. But Peters says it's not the kind of water we normally think about here on Earth.
There's no oceans, there's no clouds, there's no lakes, there's no puddles. This is completely different.
You know, it's not your grandmother's water on the moon. It isn't. You sort of have to throw out everything you think of by that phrase.
Jessica Sunshine is a researcher at the University of Maryland in College Park.
It's not liquid water. It's not frozen water, and it's not gaseous water, okay? It's none of those things. What it is a very thin film, maybe several layers of molecules thick.
She says if you could scrape all the water molecules off an area about the size of a football field, you'd get maybe a quart.
And it could be a lot less. I think our understanding is not great.
Another thing that's not yet understood is the source of the water. It seems to come and go over the course of the lunar day as temperatures change. The new findings are being published this week by the journal Science. Carly Peters says it was amazing to discover a previously unknown dynamic process on our nearest celestial neighbor.
Nature surprises us, and in this case, the moon completely surprised us. This was something that we were not expecting.
One reason space enthusiasts are so interested in water on the moon is because of hopes that it could come in handy if astronauts ever go back. NASA has been working on new rockets and space capsules for a return by 2020. There's even talk of a lunar base. Those plans are all currently under review by the Obama administration. And at a press conference this afternoon, experts pointed out that the moon's surface still looks pretty dry, despite these new findings. Jim Green is director of NASA's Planetary Science Division.
Even the driest deserts in the Earth have more water than are at the poles and the surfaces, as we've presented here, of the moon.
Still, NASA hopes to find more water next month. Scientists had long assumed if the moon had any water at all, it would be frozen at the bottom of dark, cold craters. So in October, NASA will put a spent rocket part on a collision course with that kind of crater to see if the impact kicks up evidence of buried ice. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
We asked a panel of experts at the National Museum of Natural History to discuss their favorite dinosaur. And don't be surprised, it's the T-Rex.
T-Rexes? Because they have big teeth?
T-Rex. Because it has huge teeth. A Brontosaurus.
Okay, maybe that last kid's a statistical anomaly, but for the other kids, listen up. A new discovery suggests the T-Rex wasn't the first super predator. There was actually a mini version of the T-Rex as well, called the Raptorex. And NPR's Christopher Joyce has the story.
The fossil Raptorex was found in China and dates back 125 million years. That's well before T-Rex. But the odd thing about Raptorex is that it looks just like T-Rex, except it's about 1/90th the size. About 9 feet tall, it weighed more or less what an average man does. It had T-Rex's big head, deep jaws, tiny arms, long legs, and lanky feet. But, says fossil hunter Paul Serino, it was downsized.
It is unexpected. I mean, we really thought that many of these features evolved with large body size, in the course of gaining large body size, as if there were a trend.
But the new fossil suggests that this assembly of predatory body parts isn't about size.
And what we can now say is that this is a body blueprint for a predator, jaws on legs, as it were, that is one of the most successful of the Mesozoic.
That's the era that lasted from 250 million to 65 million years ago. Serino from the University of Chicago says Raptorex may have invented this body plan, so to speak. Then T-Rex came along and supersized it. Serino also notes that the small forelimbs of T-Rex are thus not some byproduct of being really big. The arms on Raptorex are also small, just a few inches long. He thinks arms just weren't that important for any animal whose body was essentially a life support system for its jaws.
It really owes its success, I think, in large measure to its ability to run down prey and dispatch it with its jaws. And I think that's where the arms ultimately take second place.
It's sort of like a great white shark with legs, another way to look at it.
That's Greg Erickson of Florida State University, another T-Rex expert.
What surprises me is that the complex of these very small limbs and a lot of the skull reinforcement and things like that that we see in animals like T-Rex were already present in this ancestor. And so it kind of forces us to rethink the significance of the anatomy of animals like T-Rex.
The almost complete skeleton was bought by a private collector and turned over to Serino, who describes the find in the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
I got the key to the highway, built out and bound to go. I'm gonna leave here running, because walking is most too slow. I'm going bang to the bottom. Honey, why I'm better known? Because you haven't done nothing but drove a good man away from home.